funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It probably comes as no surprise that astronaut Buzz Aldrin is one of the world's most adventurous human beings. He began his career as a Korean War fighter pilot and went on to become one of only a dozen people in history to set foot on the moon, notably on that very first lunar landing in 1969. Aldrin helped establish the underwater training system astronauts use to prepare for spacewalks, and for his 80th birthday, he's 86 now, he hitched a ride on the dorsal fin of a whale shark 60 feet below the surface. He also successfully battled depression and alcoholism, and today remains an active advocate for space travel, working diligently to encourage the United States to establish a long-term colony on Mars. Buzz Aldrin's new book is called No Dream Is Too High, Life Lessons from a Man Who Walked on the Moon. Buzz, welcome to Think.
I'm happy to be here with you.
Well, we are delighted to have you. I want to ask you about this. To encourage innovation, you say that we need to embrace the idea that thinking is not wasted time. We need to stop looking busy for its own sake.
Well, you can belabor a particular thought, but unless it brings to mind fringe activities that you can begin to think around, then I think that opens the mind to be imaginative instead of just driving down one particular route where you don't see left, right, high, low. And a lot of people are just so driven and focused on one particular way of doing things, and they won't budge. They'll get very stubborn about things because they don't want to change. Well, that's a natural feeling among almost anybody. Well, if you don't change, you're not going to see something new, something surprising, something pleasant. It'll just be the same drum, dumb things. So move around, think around, look out the window.
So to
think out the box.
To get to the moon, a scientist had to let go of the longstanding idea that it would be one single spacecraft that would leave Earth, land on the moon, blast off from the moon, and return to Earth.
Well, that's absolutely true. And initially, that particular highly thought of individual, Dr. Wernher von Braun from Germany, in order to do the moon his way, we would have had to build an even bigger rocket, a 9-engine Nova rocket that wouldn't have been ready until on into the 70s. So instead, we had to use two Saturn V rockets. Now, the simpler, more economical, not the hard-driven, bullish way, is to send a spacecraft with its support systems, with the crew, and along with it you have a lander and an ascent stage. So when you get to the moon, two of the three members get into the lander and they go and land and do their activities on the surface, and the third man is in orbit in the ascent and descent spacecraft coming from and going back to the Earth. So when you're through doing things on the surface, you launch and you rendezvous with the other spacecraft. When you've done that, you can leave that ascent stage there and just bring back the crew module and a service module, which burns up in the atmosphere. And it is a far more efficient way of going to the moon. And essentially, it made the Apollo program to be as successful as it is. And as successful as that was, I now am developing ways of making use of, it's called in situ resource utilization, ISRU. Now, at the moon, what that means is ice from asteroids, comets that have impacted the moon, and the water or the ice has found itself in areas that sunshine does not get into as the moon moves around the Earth. The edges of craters that are darkened, and over millions and millions of years, it gets very cold, down to minus 250 degrees centigrade. And that is where deposits of ice are. And if we can get that and turn that into rocket fuel, liquid oxygen, and liquid hydrogen, then we can have reusable landers. The crew can get there in more efficient rocket systems, commercial crew, and the landers can go without people in them. And when they get there, they can be reusable. And it's much more efficient for other countries, Europe, Russia, Japan, and China, to become part of what I'm calling a global lunar coalition. And that brings nations together.
You have also worked very hard on this effort to encourage the United States to take the lead in creating a colony on Mars. What can we get from sending humans to Mars that we can't do with the very best and most sophisticated robotic rovers?
Well, we will get to do more and more with rovers that are there. We will bring back samples from Mars, we will be able to do many more things being close to Mars, being in orbit around Mars, and operating robots from that orbit are so much better than sending a robot from the Earth and operating it from the Earth. The time lag is so much greater. It could be as little as maybe 8 or 10 minutes, but it could be an hour and a half before you get to see whatever you talked about. Whereas if you're in orbit around Mars, it may be a second or two, the time delay, and it's much, much more accurate to make final connections. All right, it's difficult to get people to the moon of Mars, and it's more difficult to bring them back. You can just do that at certain times. Going to the moon, we can essentially go to the moon whenever we want, and then we can come back essentially whenever we want, and it is much easier. The expense of putting people at the moon of Mars for periods of time exposes them to much more radiation, so you'd have to replace those people. It is much better to begin to construct a Mars base just the way we have robotically constructed a moon base that is very similar. And then we send the same similar items to the moon, and we bring them close together from Earth with certain terminal guidance that can put them into position so that when we then get crew members to the moon of Mars, hopefully in a year and a half, they will be able to make all the final connections, certifications, and then go down and land just about the same time as more people come on the second cycler that arrives. And we do this again and again.
I was born in 1970, so I've always known space travel as a reality. I didn't quite take it for granted, but I've always understood that it was possible. Tell us about what it's like to have grown up in a time before humans had been to space, and then to find yourself among the first people to ever travel in space.
Well, I grew up in an aviation family, and I had my first ride in an airplane at 2 years old. There was unrest in the world, and there was World War II in Europe and in the Pacific, and I observed all of that as a teenager. And we used airplanes and eventually were able to end the war, I believe, with the savings of millions of lives by forcing the Japanese to realize that further conflict was not in anyone's best interest. However, about the same time, we discovered that rockets made by the Germans could begin to decimate England. And had they had those rockets combined with higher explosive or weapons of mass destruction, the results of World War II would have been entirely different. So we began to see the emergence of a rather dangerous world. And the next thing that happened was Sputnik went up into orbit, demonstrating that the Russians had the capability not only to get into orbit, but to deliver nuclear weapons at great distances. By that time, I had been in the Korean War. I had also served at the Air Force Academy when it first opened up. Then I'd been in Germany. And while there, a good friend of mine introduced me to a squadron, Ed White. He was later killed in the Apollo fire. And he rotated back shortly thereafter. An issue of Life magazine came out, and it said that we're going to begin to have a space program, and it is going to involve the Mercury program, and only test pilots will be selected to be in the Mercury program.
And you were not a test pilot.
I had chosen not to move in that direction. I felt that being in operational units in the defense of our country, right in the edge of the spear, let's say, instead of in the background, seeing that the bow and arrow had had the right construction, I wanted to be right at the operating end of things. So I didn't go through test pilot training. There were other very qualified people that did that. So it dawned on me that I just would not be eligible for this. But I had intended to go to MIT, leaving Germany anyway, at the end of the 50s in 1960. So I began to study something that would be helpful to those crew members who went into space, and that's joining together spacecraft. Once one is in orbit, you then can be launched, make maneuvers, and then approach the other spacecraft. It's called rendezvous. Well, I felt that this was very similar to intercepting other aircraft and in training for gunnery patterns where you would always look for the near-perfect approach trajectory.
And so in 19... I'm going to jump in because we have to take a quick break here. And so ultimately in 1963, NASA said, yes, we want you, Buzz Aldrin.
That's right. So I was selected and began training.
We're speaking...
I hoped that I would be able to fly in a rendezvous program, but alas, that was not to be.
We're speaking this hour with astronaut Buzz Aldrin. His new book is called No Dream Is Too High, Life Lessons from a Man Who Walked on the Moon. He'll be in town Sunday for Authors Live at Highland Park United Methodist Church. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with U.S. astronaut Buzz Aldrin. He has a new book out called No Dream is Too High, Life Lessons from a Man Who Walked on the Moon. He'll be in town Sunday for Authors Live at Highland Park United Methodist Church. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Between the Gemini 12, your first space flight in 1966, and Apollo 11 in 1969, there was, of course, the Apollo 1 disaster. Can you talk about whether that changed your sense of the dangers of space, or were you every bit as aware of it when you flew on Gemini 12?
Well, I was able to fly on Gemini 12 because of a tragedy that had occurred. My backdoor neighbor, Charlie Bassett, Air Force test pilot, was killed in a fire in St. Louis, and that opened up a backup position with Jim Lovell on a flight earlier. And that enabled me to then fly with Jim on the last flight. During spacewalking in the Gemini program, we'd been having difficulty with people getting overexerted, working too hard, perspiring, fogging up the mask, and things of that nature. So it was introduced as an idea that I welcomed very quickly, because I'd been a scuba diver for almost 10 years by this time. And it was to be in a spacesuit, pressurized, and weighted it down so we would be neutrally buoyant underwater and then slowly accomplish the tasks that we would be expected to do floating outside the spacecraft. It's a very, very close, accurate simulation, as long as you're not moving too fast, or if you have a tool or something and you drop it, of course, it isn't going to float. It's going to go right to the bottom of the swimming pool. But it gives an endurance check on the stability and the long-term motions. Now, after that flight, just a few months after, and Jim Lovell and I were still making some public appearances, and we came back and landed at the airfield one day, and the crew chief and other people came up, and they told us the very sad news that the crew of Apollo 1 had died in a very tragic fire January 27th, 1966, 67. Mm-hmm. And that delayed the initial flights of the Apollo program after that. However, on board that flight was my very, very good friend from West Point, Ed White. He was on the track team with me. I got to know him quite well. We were stationed together in a very spirited, high-spirit squadron in Germany. And he rotated back. That was before I learned in Life magazine that I had to be a test pilot. Well, he proceeded to go through some education and test pilot training. And then he called me in 1962, early, and said, NASA's going to be selecting a new group of astronauts. And he said, I'm qualified. I've been through the test pilot and this and that. And I said, well, Ed, yeah, that's great. Congratulations. But I can shoot gunnery better than you can. You know that. Besides that, I'm working on some very significant things here at MIT on manned orbital rendezvous. So I think I'll apply anyway. Well, of course, NASA selected him, but not me. But with persistence, I continued my work there successfully at MIT, visited Houston occasionally to talk to them about what they were going to be doing, and became quite familiar with that. On the third group, then I was selected, and I continued to help train some of the people for the later Gemini missions. I thought I would fly, but I didn't. So than I did because of this tragedy. And now we're waiting for the different missions of Apollo to sort of play out. And they were changeable a little bit in that time period, because it looked as though the Russians just might fly around the moon with the cosmonaut and come back before we had a chance to really get to the moon. So we accelerated some of our missions, and the second flight with the crew in Apollo went to the moon and entered lunar orbit. Only the second time in the spacecraft, the first time on the big Saturn V rocket, they went all the way to the moon and entered orbit in Christmas time of 1968. Very, very bold maneuver. And that got us caught up and ahead of the Russians, of course. And with two more missions, then the backup crew that was on that first flight with Neil Armstrong and myself on that Apollo 8 that orbited the moon, we would become the prime crew on Apollo 11. Now, the lander that we were going to have on that mission originally was not qualified to land. It was too heavy. We didn't know that way back in 67. But the manager of that flight was very interested in his spacecraft being able to land. So he felt he could reduce the weight and got permission to do that. So by the time the crews were assigned, we had a spacecraft that would land. But a couple of years earlier, things would have been different. The first landing would have been on Lunar Module 6, on Apollo 12 in October. So you can never tell how fate is going to change, and maybe you don't even know about it, but it has, and I've been in the right place at the right time so many times, and Neil, Mike, and I certainly were able to make this successful landing on time, a little bit shy of fuel, maybe because it was a little heavy, not so heavy that we couldn't land. We proved that. So we were able to have a very successful mission. And so on in the rest of the Apollo program. And by that time, after making a wonderful trip around the world, 45 days, kings and queens and parades and signs in the parade that said, "We did it." That was kind of surprising, but they said, "We did it." And that was in keeping with the plaque that we sent, put on the lander that left on the moon that said, "We came in peace for all mankind." That's sort of the way most of us felt about the whole Apollo program.
Being on the moon felt like a very spiritual experience for you.
Well, I had chosen to pay close attention to the symbolism that we had, the patch for our flight, and, of course, the call signs that we used. And we called the base Tranquility Base. But I felt if we were successful in making that first landing, there certainly ought to be some gesture of giving thanks, and each person listening in could do that in their own way. And I chose the way for me to do that was appropriately for me, was to serve myself communion, but not to tell the outside world what I was doing until a good bit later. That had become a controversial subject following, believe it or not, the Apollo 8 crew earlier reading from Genesis at Christmas Eve. People just thought that was inappropriate. Well, We did it anyway, and I did it, and so there.
Buzz, I have to ask you, so you came back from the lunar landing, as you mentioned, you know, you had this tour and you met kings and queens and heads of state, and you were and remain one of the most famous people in the world. But you were 39, and I wonder if there was a sense of, like, how can I possibly top this? And what does the rest of my life look like after achieving this goal at such a young age?
Well, all three of us on the mission felt that there were many other people who were in training, and they certainly needed a good chance to be able to go through a rotation and take their chances on being able to get to the moon. So all the three of us decided not to stay into crew rotation. Mike Collins, of course, possibly could have been the commander of the last flight that went to the moon, and he could have gone back there. Three other people did make two trips to the moon, but anyway, the three of us decided not to, and I wanted to go back to the Air Force, the service that I came from after graduating from West Point. And when my children were out of school, I did get an assignment, but not the one I was looking for. Since I had been at the new Air Force Academy when it first opened up in 1955, before going to Germany, I was hoping that I could ease back into the service after being away for 11 years by being perhaps a commandant of cadets at the Air Force Academy. Well, that didn't work out. Turns out there was a classmate of mine, very nice guy. His last name was Vandenberg. He got that assignment there. And so I was sent to command the test pilot school at Edwards. Now, I already told you I didn't go through test pilot training, so it was a little challenging to be in charge of training people at a school that I had not even experienced. But that's okay. I did very well, communicating quite well with all the students and participating in trips overseas with the instructors. But after a year, I felt that it was not leading to what I was hoping for in returning to the Air Force. So I retired after 21 years of service. Now, having cut the ties to NASA and to the Air Force, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do next. There wasn't really an opening in aviation, and there wasn't much at that time. In back at NASA, we had a Skylab space station, and we did a very good legacy-type mission with the Soviets, the Apollo-Soyuz mission in 1975. By that time, I had straightened up my excessive drinking problem by going through rehab, which has been very successful after a little difficult start, but I have 37 years of sobriety now. And once your mind is clear, you can begin to deal with disappointments, depressions that may come back. And I continue to do that. But at the same time, my mind is developing on the fringes of what we may be talking about, thinking about. And I mentioned some of these, and it's sort of absurd when we're talking about something. Turns out that that's a definition of comedy. But what I really have been doing is training my brain to think around the fringe, to think out of the box, is what we engineers call it. And it's being innovative, looking at new and better ways, improving things, seeing maybe what's wrong with what we've been doing in the last 10, 15, 20 years. And I certainly have some ideas about things that we've been doing wrong and things that we're still trying to continue to do that may be not as appropriate as they should be. It's costing us a lot of money, and it's not always doing the things that we really need that will enable us to renew the inspiring exploration that a great nation really does to inspire the rest of the world, to bring them together with us, and to inspire and inspire the education, the desire, the enthusiasm of our upcoming generations. They were really at the top of things in the 60s and 70s, but not anymore. That's right. We have STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and arts, and STEAM. We do that because we're not leading in the world the way we used to be able to do. We're not inspiring. And we can do that if we have a very vibrant exploration program that stimulates the technologies that then result in better living conditions for everyone here on Earth. And we bring together other nations to join us in what we're doing by not competing with people, but helping them in their desires to go to the moon while we learn a few things that we have to do at Mars, then we all can begin to go to Mars with the cycling orbit techniques that I've developed that go way back to 1985, and they've been improved, and I've cultivated a very attractive overall plan that starts by putting things into orbit before NASA plans to put their astronauts with a government-designed rocket and a spacecraft.
I'm going to jump in here. We have to take another quick break. My guest is U.S. astronaut Buzz Aldrin. His new book is called No Dream is Too High, Life Lessons from a Man Who Walked on the Moon. He'll be in town Sunday for Authors Live at Highland Park United Methodist Church in Dallas. We'll come back to our conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
Buzz Lightyear to Star Command. Come in, Star Command. Star Command, come in. Do you read me? Answer.
My ship!
Blast. This will take weeks to repair. Buzz Lightyear mission log, stardate 4072. My ship has run off course en route to Sector 12. I've crash-landed on a strange planet. The impact must have awoken me from hypersleep. Terrain seems a bit unstable. No readout yet if the air is breathable. And there seems to be no sign of intelligent life anywhere.
Hello?
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard Disney's Toy Story released in 1995. That was the character Buzz Lightyear, inspired by my guest, Buzz Aldrin, retired U.S. astronaut. His new book is called No Dream is Too High, Life Lessons from a Man Who Walked on the Moon. Do you have a Buzz Lightyear toy in your office somewhere?
Well, I certainly do. I have a very special one. It's a silver-coated Buzz Lightyear, and it's signed by the person who took over the program for Toy Story, because when he did, the story had been written using a space person called Lunar Larry. And somehow he just didn't think that that was appropriate. So he said, hey, would somebody get me a list of the astronauts that we have, the real ones? And so he went down the list and he decided that Buzz was a very attractive name. It's a short one and it's nice. I hear it and I answer. and other people hear it and it's unusual. So he decided to put something at the end of it, Lightyear. Well, that's sort of spacey sounding. So then I read in the magazine that that Toy Story is coming out, and it has a toy in there, a space person, whose name is Buzz Lightyear. Well, that was kind of a surprise. After a while, I did get a call from somebody, and they said, hey, we'd like you to come over to the production studio and maybe see what we're doing. And so as we walked approaching the door, he said, well, the character who's playing this spaceman, Buzz Lightyear, would like to have some pictures taken with you holding the doll. Somehow a thought went through my mind. Now, wait a minute. Before we do this, shouldn't we really have an agreement, a total agreement? Well, somehow we rushed on in and went on and went and took the pictures. And certainly I was invited to do all these things and whatever. Anyway, I supported the character, the movie, and everything, but, you know, somehow I felt like they made a lot of money off of that, and not much was shared with me. And it's kind of like the government payment for astronauts who go to the moon. We didn't get paid anything special at all, not one bit.
Hmm.
Just regular Air Force pay.
How much was that in 1969? Do you remember?
Well, it was much lower than the civilians who flew in with NASA in space, who were civil servants, but we were military people. A special promotion policy put forth by President Johnson turned out, by the mixing of the dates, that I lost 6 months of seniority when it was supposed to be a big gift. Of an additional promotion.
Hmm.
Well, somehow it just never seemed to me quite right that the government, the business world, and others just maybe don't seem to value. Whenever you're a government person, whether Air Force or civil servant, and you are going on a trip, when you come back from the trip, you file a travel voucher that indicates your expenses during that trip. Well, now on this trip from Houston to Florida, from Florida to the moon, to the Pacific Ocean, to aircraft carrier, to Pearl Harbor, then to Hickam Field, then a flight back to Houston, most of all of that was government travel and government meals. And government quarters. So I filed my travel voucher, and I got $33 back. Well, that covered the rental car that I had to engage to go from the Air Force base in Florida to the crew quarters. Not sure how that car got back there, but that's immaterial. The fact is that that was the government payment for my travel. No retirement from NASA. When I did retire, later my retirement pay, appropriately, I split with my wife that I divorced because of things. Well, I get that back now because she just recently died, but no real thanks. But I did take an oath when I was 17 years old to serve my country. And I can guarantee you that the motivation for everything I've been doing of significance ever since that has been motivated to do the best I can with my education, my talents, to improve things for this country.
It's a cool bit of trivia that your mother's maiden name was Moon. And you write in the book that you are very supportive of women in the space program, which they really weren't back when you were flying.
Well, I don't know why not. They're quite talented when it comes to remembering things that some of us scatterbrained people have other thoughts on our mind. There are fighter pilots that are doing quite well. I'm not so sure that being in a foxhole with other ladies are exactly the way that combat ought to be conducted. But there's a lot of differences of opinion on many of those things. But certainly, there's no reason why we can't have females as part of the crew. I think in particular, part of the missions that I've planned from starting as soon as we can in 2018, beginning to build a space station that can replace the old wearing out station that we have now, but can also be patterned after the construction of the cycling spacecraft that will take us to Mars. Now, with all of those build-up missions that take advantage of what we now know about the moon, we can take a spacecraft and a habitat and fly around Venus. Well, that's closer than Mars is, and we can do that sooner for inspiration and a large number of engineering and scientific things that could be recovered. Well, I think it's only natural that Venus have a female crew fly by there as the men are the first to land on Mars, I guess. Anyway, I certainly feel that there's a camaraderie that should be cultivated in missions that will be longer and longer. I certainly am a very strong advocate of planning missions that go to the moon or to Mars so that construction will be done remotely from Earth and then from Mars orbit to be able to permanently house crew members once they land. There are three things you can do with Mars. You can visit and come back, and then Mars is empty. You can go and stay and keep somebody there, but you're bringing people back, which is quite expensive to send them and then bring them back. They're very, very valuable with billions and billions of dollars invested in them. And you can inhabit. That's what I think our objective should be. I understand that that would rub some people the wrong way, but not the people who really want to go and not the leader who appreciates the legacy that he or she would have by making a commitment before the second term is up that the United States will lead other nations to inhabit Mars.
What is the secret to keeping such a youthful attitude that you have had all these years? You're 86 years old now. You still are scuba diving. You had this amazing 80th birthday ride on a whale shark. Other than having kept yourself physically in very good condition, what keeps you mentally so young?
Well, it's thinking of new and better and exciting things to be done. I'm not a mountain climber, so I don't really think about climbing mountains, and I found out that I'm not very consistent with golf, and that takes up an awful lot of time. I didn't start skiing because, you know, I really want to be first in something that I do if I can, but I put on skis at age 50 finally, but now I think that's a little strenuous for some of the joints and muscles and other things, so I probably have skied down the last slope. Never know. But I found much more fascinating things to do. My lady partner and I flew around the world with her in a Cessna Citation Mustang with a number of other folks, many, many stops and refueling, just many different, and she's still doing that. I have a couple of charities that I'm pursuing, a think tank that I'm real anxious to get underway in Washington so that we can look at the good decisions and the not so good that have caused us to get somehow to the position we're in today and have been for the last 4 or 5 years. We can't even fly our own people. Where we are today is worse than we were a week, a month before Kennedy spoke to Congress, committing us to go to the moon. At least we had an organization, we had a program, Mercury, and we had people training to do that. We don't know where we're going. We have vague words about this or that. We need a plan, and that's what I have come up with. It's called Cycling Pathways to Mars. Learn about it. You'll see that it's the best thing that this country could possibly do to inspire our young people with the education that they need to be able to be the ones to carry out these exciting missions in the future.
Would you go to Mars if a spot were offered to you on a mission in the next few years?
In the next few years, well,
2039 is the date.
That's not really an appropriate question. I hope to be able to still be around at 100, maybe 105, but I don't think I'll quite make it to 2040. But I have a son who's coming along and managing a lot of things for me, very talented, but he's a manager also. And some people are doers, are crewmen. Some people love the outdoor, the challenge of working with the surroundings. There are other people who are thinkers, planners, and managers to carry out the inspiring plans. But we've got to have a destination, a time, and a plan to get there.
Buzz Aldrin's new book is called No Dream is Too High, Life Lessons from a Man Who Walked on the Moon. He'll be in town Sunday to speak to authors live at Highland Park United Methodist Church in Dallas. Buzz, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Well, thank you. I look forward to being in Dallas, one of my favorite cities.
Wonderful. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Alex Smith. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.